From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we start this hour with the last Supreme Court decision of this session, a big defeat for labor unions. The court ruled in another 5-4 vote that workers who are not in unions don't have to pay a fee for the benefits they get that unions bargain for. The court deciding that violates their free speech rights. President Trump hailed the decision in a tweet as a big loss for the coffers of the Democrats, because unions largely support Democrats. Emily Bazelon, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School, is here. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
Well, we know this case was brought by an Illinois state employee, Mark Janis, who chose not to join his workplace union, but was still required to pay a fee for the collective bargaining that negotiated his contract. What did the conservative justices say in their decision overruling this about free speech? What did they say?
Well, this is a 5-4 decision. The majority opinion is by Justice Sam Alito, who, you're right, is one of the conservatives on the court. And in order to reach this result, he has to overrule a 40-plus-year-old case of the Supreme Court's called Abood. And so the question is, how do you go about that? And the chief reason Justice Alito gives is that the First Amendment, the right to not have your speech compelled by having to pay dues to a union you don't support, is more important than the free rider problem here. And what I mean by that is the unions were arguing, look, these are people we have to represent. If this is a teachers union, we're talking about all the teachers, and they get all the benefits of the collective bargaining we do. And so we should be able to collect fees from them for our collective bargaining activities, not our partisan political activities, but for the collective bargaining we do. Alito says, sorry, that means that we're asking these employees to support speech they don't want to support, and that's more important than the free rider issue.
And that being people who were getting a free ride. But you mentioned the Abood decision. This was 1977, and this was making a distinction between two kinds of payments, that forcing nonmembers to pay for a union's political activities violated their First Amendment. But it was constitutional, that court said, to require them to pay for the collective bargaining. And so unions since then have had sort of a kickback to those who just pay the fee for the collective bargaining. They kick back a certain amount of money that would cover what would be their advertising or their partisan work, correct?
Exactly. And we're also only talking about the 22 states that wanted to have unions collect dues in this way. There are 28 states, we think of them as right-to-work states, where public sector unions were not allowed to collect these kind of fees automatically. So, you know, what's important about that, especially from the point of view of the more liberal justices in dissent, is that the court is taking away a set of rules that these states and their voters wanted to have.
Well, and you mentioned that it's called right-to-work states because people who are against this union requirement have labeled it that way. They say that it's a right to work without having to pay that fee. But does this mean essentially that every state now has a so-called right to work law?
Effectively, yes. I think that is basically the way to think about it, that unions are no longer going to be able to collect dues from all their members. They're going to have to persuade their members to join. And, you know, it's a perfectly rational decision. If you're a teacher and you know that your union will still be bargaining for your benefits and you're low on cash one month, not paying your dues starts to look like a kind of rational thing to do, because you're still going to get the benefit of the union's work and you'll save yourself the cash.
Tell us more about the arguments in favor of the union. Yes, there was the free rider, but some talked about the fact that, for instance, we all get taxed for things that we may not participate in. You may not have children in school. You're still taxed for the children that go to school. You know, what other arguments were they making?
Well, that is an important one. And, you know, also it is standard in this country to have certain professional organizations be allowed to collect dues. So, you know, I'm a lawyer, not a lawyer you would ever want to hire. But if I want to be part of the Connecticut Bar Association, I have to pay dues. And the Connecticut Bar Association has a kind of sort of governmental function in some way in terms of disciplining lawyers. Similarly, states that have legislated agency fees where workers pay this money to unions have said, this is the best and easiest way for us to bargain. Mm-hmm. We want employees all represented by one union. We want to deal with them that way. And that's why we're letting unions have this power. That, of course, has now been taken away.
Right. So that was the big news out of the court so far today. But you noted something else.
Yes. Well, there was a lot of chatter about whether Justice Anthony Kennedy would retire today on the last day of the term, and that did not happen. The Supreme Court announced the end of the term with no retirements from any justices. That doesn't mean Justice Kennedy can't retire on another day this summer or whenever he chooses. But I think a lot of people who are worried about what will happen on the court if President Trump chooses a successor for Justice Kennedy, they will breathe a sigh of relief.
Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and also a fellow at Yale Law School. Emily, thanks for the whole Supreme Court season.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
President Trump will be in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin tomorrow for the groundbreaking of Foxconn's giant LCD manufacturing plant, perhaps hoping to take some of the focus off of the Wisconsin company that is planning to shift production overseas. That would be Harley Davidson. Trump advocated for Foxconn to come to Wisconsin. The Taiwan-based electronics company is building a $10 billion complex in Racine County and promising up to 13,000 jobs. And state and local officials offered Foxconn $4.5 billion in tax incentives, prompting cries of corporate welfare. There are also concerns about the impact the operation would have on air and water quality. Marty Michelson from member station WUWM reports.
It's a picture-perfect, sunny Saturday at the Harbor Market in Kenosha, Wisconsin, just a few miles from where Foxconn's LCD screen factory will be built. Thousands of people are here, roaming the Lake Michigan shoreline, purchasing fresh meats, produce, and flowers. I'm begging of you, please don't. A folk band is providing entertainment. While the market is a far cry from a political event, many people here are aware that President Trump will be in town tomorrow for the groundbreaking. Curzio Caravati is a beekeeper and lives close to the Foxconn site. He says he's concerned about the amount of air pollution such a massive operation could cause. He says bees are sensitive to elevated ozone levels.
And I'm planning on having hives very close to Foxconn so that we can monitor how bees are going to survive the potential air pollution that Foxconn may or may not produce.
The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources recently approved permits that would allow Foxconn to discharge pollutants from toxic chemicals used in its operation. State documents show the factory would constitute a major new source of air pollution in the region. Another big concern is water. Foxconn needs lots of it to manufacture its liquid crystal displays. The state recently granted permission for Foxconn to use 7 million gallons of water per day from Lake Michigan. The city of Racine would tap the water and pipe it 10 miles out to the factory. The local water utility would treat the wastewater and return it to the lake. Still, Cheryl Clark is skeptical. She lives near the site and worries about the impact on water quality.
What they do with the water that is returned to Lake Michigan, how they process it, is it filtered, what's it used for in whatever they're making.
Republican Governor Scott Walker insists that the water diversion plan will not harm Lake Michigan. But his promises haven't satisfied environmentalists, and a number of groups have filed a legal challenge to rescind the state's approval of the plan. Attorney Jimmy Parra represents the groups. He argues the state violated provisions in the Great Lakes Compact in approving the water diversion.
So the Great Lakes Compact is an interstate agreement among all the states in the Great Lakes region, and it prohibits diversions of Great Lakes water out of the basin, except in very limited circumstances. In any circumstance, it has to be for a public purpose, a public water supply purpose. And here, what's happening is that the water is being sent out of the basin for a private purpose.
Parra says it could take about 6 months for a Wisconsin judge to issue a ruling. If it's not to the environmental group's liking, a long court battle is expected. The request for the water diversion came from Racine Mayor Corey Mason. He interprets the wording of the compact differently.
If you look at what the compact actually says in terms of residential use, but also allowing for a mix of industrial use, what Foxconn application has here is certainly fits within that standard as it works with Mount Pleasant and the city of Racine to determine if it's an appropriate use of water under the Great Lakes Compact. And I think that it does.
Mason says he's confident that Foxconn will meet federal and state environmental standards. He was a member of the state legislature last year when it approved the tax incentives that resulted in Foxconn locating to Wisconsin. Minority Democrats opposed the deal, calling it enormous corporate welfare. They also lamented reports that show it'll take 25 years for Wisconsin taxpayers to recoup their $4 billion investment. For Here and Now, I'm Marty Michelson in Milwaukee.
A federal judge in California has ordered a nationwide injunction on the separation of migrant children from their parents. The order, issued yesterday, also gives officials a 30-day deadline to reunify families that had already been divided by President Trump's zero-tolerance immigration policy. The president issued an executive order ending that policy last week, but more than 2,000 children remain split from their families. Alan Gomez covers immigration for USA Today. Alan, first tell us what the judge said.
Quite simply, the judge ordered the department to completely stop the practice of separating children, and it created very hard deadlines for the administration to start reunifying these families. They must at least establish contact with their children within 10 days. Children who are five or under must be reunified with their parents within 14 days, and all of these minors have to be reunified with their parents within 30 days. The judge allowed for some children to continue to be separated, but only in extreme cases where the parents or the adults who are traveling with them present some sort of immediate danger to the children. But otherwise, the practice must end, and these families must be reunified within those 30 days.
But this is going to be a logistical challenge for the administration to put all these kids back together with their parents, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, the Department of Health and Human Services, which is responsible for these children, says that they can account for every single one of them. They can find them within a matter of seconds. But as a practical matter, these kids are spread out all over the country. Their parents are spread out all over the country. And really complicating this are a series of court rulings and U.S. laws that limit the amount of time that children can stay in custody. So even if you reunify a parent, let's say, with their child, all of a sudden that starts this 20-day clock that the child can't be in custody longer than 20 days. So in some cases, they might actually have to start releasing some of these families because of this order. So it's going to be hard to get them together in the first hand. And then secondly, making those individual case-by-case determinations about how long they can stay in custody, whether they have to start releasing them, and what comes after that.
So when you look at this court case, when you look at the other decisions, when you look at President Trump's executive order and then his taking back of the executive order, what's happening in Congress, where are we with this at this point, with family separation?
Well, we're no closer to getting a bill passed in Congress. The administration is still insists that there is going to be some form of zero tolerance policy when it comes to prosecuting adults. And I don't think the Trump administration in any way is going to ease up on its immigration enforcement efforts generally. So what's changed is that these separations may be ending, but the overall posture of the Trump administration to really go hard on immigration and continue immigration enforcement in every way that they can imagine, I think, is going to continue. It might be different tactics. They might use different methods to try to deter people from coming to the border. But in practice, I think the only thing that's going to change is that these specific separations are going to come to an end.
It's Alan Gomez of USA Today. Alan, thank you.
Thank you.
Wildfires continue to burn in Northern California, the largest in Lake County, about 120 miles north of San Francisco. No lives have been lost, but about 1,500 people were forced to evacuate. More than 2,700 firefighters have been battling the blaze. Several structures have been destroyed, including the home of Katie Brogan and her family in Spring Valley. They raise pigs and other animals. The animals are safe. Her husband was about to open a coffee shop. All the new equipment is gone. Katie joins us now. And Katie, we are so sorry to hear about this. And thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us.
You're welcome. And thank you for your kind words.
And tell us what happened to your house, as far as you know.
It burned all the way to the ground. I was able to... we lost it early in the incident Saturday night. My husband was still in the valley at that point, and discovered he had left his insulin pens at the house and went back for them, and the house was gone.
So there was really no time to get anything?
No, not really. I've recently out of the hospital recovering from a full hip replacement, mm-hmm. and so I was kind of like in the hospital bed and stuff, and I'd spent most of the day at home because the husband and the kids had been away at a show pig seminar in Ukiah because the kids show swine through 4-H and FFA at the Lake County Fair. So I'd been there most of the day by myself, and this started up about 5. And when he got home at about 5:30, he's like, yeah, we need to get Mom out of here. So he really didn't want us grabbing anything. He was more concerned about just getting out. So he had the kids just help me with my walker to the car, and we headed down to Spring Valley Pantry to wait and see.
And how long was it after that before the house burned?
I think it was probably before midnight.
What kind of things did you lose? What are you thinking of that is gone now?
Oh my gosh, it's weird. Things pop into your mind at different times. My kids' mementos. I had a kid that just graduated 8th grade, and he had won the President's Academic Achievement Award and had received a letter from Donald Trump and a pin and other commendations that he'd received. You know, those kinds of things. My daughter's wrestling medals, her FFA jacket with her state degree pin on it. Not like really expensive possessions or things that you desire, mm-hmm. but things that your memories are tied to.
What about you personally? I mean, those are both things that are your kids. What about you?
Memories of my dad, pictures, some family heirloom jewelry, all my Carhartt stuff. I'm a big Grateful Dead fan, so all my Grateful Dead stuff's gone. Just kind of things that might seem stupid to somebody else.
Do you still feel kind of like you're in a state of shock now, processing all of this?
I haven't checked into all of this, but I'm sure that there's probably been identified a process that we move through, and I'm not sure where I'm at on that. I've cried a bit. Right now I'm kind of just doing the strong thing. I kind of gave up hip replacement recovery mode and for fire survival mode. We're just taking it a minute at a time right now.
I understand that you have actually had to evacuate several times over the years. You've been living in Spring Valley for decades. Did this time feel different to you?
Yeah, kind of. I've almost felt like it was coming. In our 4-H group, I've had friends that lost their homes in the Valley Fire. And then the next time around, friends that lost their homes in the Clayton Fire. And I don't know, I've just sort of felt like this was coming.
Have you reached out to those friends now, as you have to deal with this yourself?
I have, and I've apologized to them for trite things that were said and the things that well-meaning people say that really don't have any impact on your hopefulness or anything. They're just, you know, they don't know what else to say.
What is the wrong thing to say?
The wrong thing to say is, at least you got out okay. At least. It's mostly those two words, at least. Sometimes I have a problem with, and I shouldn't, but sometimes I have a problem with thoughts and prayers. I'm like, what am I going to do with those?
So what do you think it's going to take now for you to get back up on your feet after this?
My husband is a lot more positive than I am. I'm like, well, we've just lost all your stuff. And he's just really positive about, well, we still have this and this. And we can replace that and that. And his power of being positive is just, it's beautiful and overwhelming at the same time. And I think if we can keep focused and just keep, I'm sure there's going to be a fight ahead to stay positive and to stay focused and to just keep wanting to go on. But we'll do it. I do it for the kids.
How are your kids doing?
My daughter is away at American Legion Girls State Conference in Southern California. My husband had to drive her down there Sunday. It was a great honor that she was nominated for this, and we didn't want her to miss out on the opportunity. Unfortunately, I'm worried for her, and I don't know where her head is, and I wish she was able to be fully involved in the program that she's at without having to worry about us. My son, who's your typical 14-year-old, has been strangely polite and quiet and very cooperative. And while that's all lovely and very welcomed, it's kind of worrisome in a way because it's not really like him. And I'm not sure if it's out of strength of character and he's just trying to be the best person he can be right now, or if he's in shock. It's probably a combination of both of those things.
And what are you saying to him?
I'm telling him I love him a lot. Unfortunately, my mobility is still limited. I'm asking him to do things that he normally would be like rolling his eyes and trying not to do, you know, tasks and chores and things like that. And he's just done it all without having to ask him twice.
That's Katie Brogan of Spring Valley, California. She lost her home in the Pawnee Fire. Katie, thank you.
Thank you.
That California couple raising money to reunite families separated at the border had hoped to raise about $1,500, but within days they received donations from about 500,000 people, and now their total raised is over $20 million. $20 million. It made us want to take a quick look at giving with Elizabeth Dunn, associate professor at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver and author of the book Happy Money. Elizabeth, your thoughts on that $20 million, one couple with absolutely no personal ties to these migrants.
It is a pretty astonishing number, but to be honest, I'm not really surprised that people are working so hard to raise money for this cause and that we're seeing such an outpouring of support. People have a profound desire to help others with whom they empathize. So this experience of empathy seems to be the number one reason why people help others. Mm-hmm. Empathy really occurs when we feel somebody else's pain, when we can kind of take their perspective. And what I think we're seeing here is that I believe, especially for parents, it's just so easy to experience kind of viscerally what it would feel like to have your child taken away from you. And I think that is what is behind this real outpouring of support.
What about social media?
Well, I think social media is also playing an important role. I know on my Facebook feed, practically everybody I know is posting something about raising money for this cause. And that creates what psychologists would call a strong descriptive norm, whereby we kind of all have this impression that many other people around us are donating money to this cause. And social media is giving us a window into the donations that other people we know are making, which is likely to increase our feeling that, you know, we ourselves should donate.
Yeah. And what about wealth? In your research, is it the wealthiest who make donations to causes?
Surprisingly, wealthy people in a lot of research actually seem to donate a lower percentage of their incomes to charity than people with less income. Mm. And remarkably, what we see in our work is that people around the world experience benefits from giving to charity even when they're actually struggling to meet their very own basic needs.
Huh, interesting. That's actually been our experience in being on the end of fundraising, asking people maybe to contribute to public radio or, you know, to any group that you might be involved with, that people often who have very little give what little they can. This isn't an American phenomenon or a North American phenomenon. You've seen this around the world.
Yeah, we've conducted parallel experiments everywhere from Canada and India to Uganda and South Africa. And what we see is that in countries around the world, people experience joy from giving to others. And what's really remarkable to me is we observe this even when we study groups of people who say they're having a hard time putting food on the table. Still, even among these kinds of individuals, we see people experiencing joy from actually using their own very limited resources to help others.
Might even feel better. Elizabeth Dunn, associate professor at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, with some thoughts. After that, California couple wanting to raise money to reunite families separated on the border found themselves raising $20 million, and they're still going. Professor Dunn, Elizabeth, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Next month, Mars will make its closest approach to Earth in 15 years. Observers are hoping the view will help us gain more useful information about the planet's weather and surface conditions. And the mystery of Mars continues to fascinate Michio Kaku, a world-renowned theoretical physicist, futurist, and author. His latest book is The Future of Humanity, Terraforming Mars, Interstellar Travel, Immortality, and Our Destiny Beyond Earth. I spoke with Michio Kaku when he was in Boston for the Live Works Technology Conference. Well, let's first talk about Mars. There is so much talk now from people, including Elon Musk of SpaceX right now, about colonizing Mars. He wants to send a cargo mission there by 2022. How soon do you think we're going to have humans on the red planet?
Well, let's be honest about it. It takes only 3 days to go to the moon. So the moon is a hop, skip, and a jump from the Earth. And I personally believe that at some point in the future, people will honeymoon on the moon. Hmm. Now, Mars, as you point out, is a whole nother ball of wax. 2 years for a round-trip mission to Mars, plus, of course, all the problems of weightlessness, micrometeorites, radiation, stuff like that. But there are technical problems. We, of course, have sent robot probes to Mars, quite a few of them, in fact. And there are real plans now to go to Mars in the 2030s. First to the moon, according to a new presidential directive signed in December. First to the moon, using the moon as a base, and then on to Mars, perhaps around the 2030s, and maybe after that, mining the asteroid belt. So things that were once the stuff of science fiction are now being translated into real rocket science.
Why stop on the moon? Why does that make it easier?
Well, the moon, you can actually bypass the moon. There was a split within the space program with some astronauts saying we should use the moon as a station, a permanent manned space station on the moon. Other people say, well, why bother? Why not simply skip it and go directly to Mars? And that's manifested in the rocket program of today. NASA has set its sights on the moon using the SLS booster rocket to take astronauts to the moon starting next year. The first unmanned SLS booster rocket mission will take place around December of 2019, while Elon Musk, he wants to bypass the moon entirely and go all the way to the planet Mars with his Falcon Heavy and what he calls the BFR rocket. And so we actually have two plans on the table, one to use the moon as a base of operations, and the other one to simply skip the moon and go to Mars directly.
And what's the long-term plan with Mars? Why are we so focused on getting to Mars? It's not really a planet that could support life as we know it on Earth.
Right. Well, first, we want to begin the process of terraforming Mars. If you could somehow, in the future, raise the temperature of Mars by 6 degrees, you could induce an artificial greenhouse effect and it would take off all by itself. Some people think that if you have satellites, solar satellites that orbit Mars and reflect sunlight down to the polar ice caps, then you could melt the polar ice caps and then rivers and seas could once again flow freely on the surface of Mars like they did about 3.5 billion years ago. And then bioengineered plants would thrive in the atmosphere. Plants love carbon dioxide, and it may be possible to genetically modify algae and plants that'll grow in that environment. And then mining operations could also take place. The first thing you want to mine would be ice to extract drinking water once you purify it, and also break it up into oxygen and hydrogen for rocket fuel and for breathing purposes. And so the key word is self-sustaining. You don't want a Mars colony to be a drain on the U.S. economy. No, you want it to be self-sustaining, to have its own mining, to have its own agriculture and its own industries. And, of course, this is more long-term. We're not talking about this happening anytime soon.
Right.
But the basic groundwork is being laid now, even as we speak.
And is it going to be a private company, do you think, that makes it there first, or is it going to be a government space agency?
Well, that's the key question. You see, back in the 60s, it was all done by the government, and things were really, really expensive. In 1966, the Apollo space program budget soaked up 5% of the entire federal budget. That's incredible. That's you cannot self-sustain a space program with that kind of cost, 5% of the federal budget. Now prices have dropped dramatically. In fact, the movie The Martian, starring Matt Damon, cost $100 million.
Right.
But the Indians sent a probe to Mars for $70 million. So a Hollywood movie to Mars costs more than actually going to Mars. That's how much the price has dropped. Normally, it costs about $10,000 to put a pound of anything into orbit. That's your weight in gold. Think of your body made out of solid gold. That's what it costs to put you just into orbit around the Earth. However, Elon Musk has claimed that he could bring down the cost by a factor of 10. And so that would open up outer space for development. And remember that these people have a vision for the future. Elon Musk's vision is that we become a multi-planet species, because after all, the dinosaurs did not have a space program.
Right.
And that's why the dinosaurs aren't here today. So we need a backup plan, says Elon Musk. But then Jeff Bezos, richest man in the world, head of Amazon, states that he wants to make the Earth into a garden. He wants to put polluting industries into outer space so the Earth becomes a park, a garden that basically is a testament to a clean environment, to a new vision for the planet Earth. So we have Silicon Valley billionaires coming in with a new vision, new energy, and of course, big bucks.
We're speaking with physicist Michio Kaku, and I want to ask you about a couple of other things. One of the biggest advancements, it seems, in recent years in the world of physics is the ability for us to detect gravitational waves. We've talked about LIGO, these big detectors that are in different parts of the United States, and we've been able to do that. What do you think the significance of that is?
Oh, well, I think it's tremendous. Eventually, we'll put LIGO into outer space. That's called LISA, Laser Interferometry Space Antenna. It is three satellites connected by laser beams that detect gravity waves from the Big Bang itself. We're going to get baby pictures of the infant universe, maybe a trillionth of a second after the instant of creation. Now, the pictures of the Big Bang that you see on the internet are pictures that were taken more or less when the universe was 300,000 years old. But we don't want that. We want baby pictures of the universe leaving the womb at the instant of creation. And physicists like myself hope to pick up evidence of an umbilical cord of the infant universe as it emerges from the womb, connecting it to a parent universe. The point I'm raising is that with gravity wave detectors in outer space, we may just have the possibility of detecting the pre-Big Bang universe.
How?
See, if you pick up radiation at the instant of the Big Bang or just afterwards, you could run the videotape backwards. String theory is what I do for a living. That's my day job. And string theory is a theory that goes even beyond Einstein and goes before the Big Bang. And string theory makes several predictions as to what the pre-Big Bang universe was like. And we may be able to run the videotape backwards on LISA to detect radiation before the instant of creation to give us an inkling of the pre-Big Bang universe. Now, in string theory, which is not yet confirmed, I should emphasize that fact, we know that the universe is a bubble of some sort. That's Einstein's picture. The bubble is expanding. String theory says that there are other bubbles out there. And these bubbles can bump into each other or peel off baby bubbles, and that's the Big Bang. So the Big Bang is nothing but the collision of universes or the fissioning off of baby universes, and this is called the multiverse theory. You can go to any physics conference, and there's always some session on the multiverse. It's one of the hottest topics now in quantum cosmology, the application of quantum mechanics, string theory, to Einstein's theory of the Big Bang.
Got all that? That's theoretical physicist Michio Kaku. We will continue our conversation tomorrow and talk about dark energy, dark matter, alien life, artificial intelligence, and the state of science education.
Vice President Mike Pence is in Latin America. Tomorrow he heads to Guatemala, where he'll meet with leaders from that country and El Salvador and Honduras. He's expected to defend the president's immigration crackdown, as Pence did in Brazil yesterday, with a warning for people heading to the U.S. If you can't come legally, don't come at all. Pence also touted the aid that the U.S. gives the region. Last week, President Trump had this message about that aid.
Now think of all that aid that we give some of these countries, hundreds of millions of dollars we give to some of these countries, and they send them up. Well, I'm going to go very shortly for authorization that when countries abuse us by sending their people up, not their best, we're not going to give any more aid to those countries. Why the hell should we? Why should we?
Well, that aid was intended under the Obama administration to help countries solve the drug and gang violence problems driving people north to safety in the U.S. So what's true about these funds? Eric Olson is deputy director of the Latin American program at the Wilson Center. Eric, the foreign aid, when the vice president was talking about aid, he was talking about money allocated under the Obama administration. But now that funding is dropping, right?
It has begun to drop, but I think it's really important to remember that that money is approved by Republicans and Democrats in Congress. It's investments in dealing with long-term intractable problems like gangs, like corruption, like poverty and lack of employment and education. They require a commitment over time from the United States.
Well, and the irony is, with the president's threat of cutting even more, the more, it sounds like you're saying, the more funds you cut, the more migration you'll have, because the problems will be bigger.
If we don't address these drivers of migration, then there will be a continuation of this phenomenon. So simply to cut the legs out from under these programs, to slash and burn them, probably means that these problems and issues won't be addressed and migration will continue.
You know, talk about the thinking behind the aid. It was not to prop up these countries, but help them to fight what?
Three areas. One, to deal with the security problems. Secondly, to do with their governance problems. That means the functioning of their police, their prosecutors, their judges. These countries have enormous problems with corruption. So that was a central piece of it. And the third area was the poverty and inequality these countries face. If people don't have a sense of hope, they become desperate and flee.
The vice president also talked about people coming legally, but the administration ended a program that allows a parent legally in the U.S. to apply for their children to come, to avoid that dangerous journey that the vice president spoke of. This is the Central American Minors Program. Why was that ended?
That was a program that allowed people in these countries to apply for political asylum there, not have to come to the border. It faced enormous bureaucratic burdens within the U.S. government. This administration decided to just end that program. Frankly, I think that's one element of what can be done to improve the situation and discourage people from coming on that journey that's so dangerous.
Well, the other thing is to get the word out. And after the huge surge in 2014 under the Obama administration of young unaccompanied minors coming to the U.S., escaping this gang violence, it was pretty well documented. There were ads that were made, Spanish language ads that would run in these countries to encourage them not to make this dangerous trip. That public awareness campaign was also cut. Eric Olson, just comment on how we got here, because a lot of the aid that has been going to these countries went to military conflicts, supporting the Contras in Nicaragua, fighting the socialist government there. In Guatemala, a UN Truth Commission in 1999 found the U.S. bore some responsibility for training and financing troops for that country's former dictator, who was convicted of genocide. Is there some historical responsibility for some of the brokenness of some of these countries?
I think there's no question that there is a historical responsibility here. The U.S. was very much a part of the civil wars and conflicts in Central America. Ronald Reagan made Central America the kind of the front lines of the Cold War during his administration. And the vestiges of those conflicts, I think, continued to divide and weaken the country. You have an enormous stash of arms that have been left over. You have criminal groups that have gone from being guerrillas now to being criminal actors. there's a lot of roots back to the 1980s that give a context to the current conflict. But I would add one other thing. There are things now that are driving this conflict. It has a lot to do with the consumption of illegal drugs in the United States. That's what's made this area a territory of conflict for drug trafficking. It's been weak government and corruption that has hollowed out the presidencies of several of those countries. The U.S. has a role to play, has some responsibility in these cases, and I think there's a lot we are overlooking when we see that region.
Eric Olson, Deputy Director of the Latin American Program at the Wilson Center. Eric, thanks as always.
Very welcome.